left him. Yes. That's why I think it's very appropriate, right?
Absolutely.
Who urged him to be silent as bombs were being dropped on helpless people. And he did not do that. And so I think in that spirit, that's the spirit in which we proceed in our conversation.
Yes.
We're going to talk a lot about theory today. Not that theory is irrelevant, but I do think it is important for us to ground ourselves in the reality of what is going on right now. And Nora, if you would just take a moment for us and speak to the ongoing genocide, the pain, the life lost, frankly, the role that we as Americans play in that. If you would just take a moment for us just to ground us so that we are not forgetting, so that we are not, you know, all the way up here. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Thank you, Ta-Nehisi. Thank you, Kianga, and to this audience again. Thank you for coming to find sanctuary collectively. I think that this was a concern that after more than a year of watching slaughter of babies, this is essentially and continues to be a war on children.
Yes.
In a besieged territory where 50% of the population is children. So even before a bomb is dropped, it is a war on children. That it's really easy to then pivot to the theoretical piece to make sense of it. We want to make sense of it at this stage, and what gets lost is what's happening. And so I appreciated full transparency. Ta-Nehisi asked me to do this just, you know, right before this event. So I thought that the proper way to do it was actually to read testimony from the ground, from a colleague who in Gaza, who is recounting, as of 6 a.m. this morning, one of his colleagues woke up to 32 members of his family who were killed in Jabalia. And Jabalia is in the north, which is now under now an even tighter siege in a campaign of extermination and ethnic cleansing. What he writes upon waking up at 6 a.m. and finding his family slaughtered is that, quote, "I live meters away from them. It is a matter of luck. I wish I died with them. Neither my heart or mind can tolerate this. My uncle, his wife, and three sons and grandsons and daughters all deleted." He also lost his brother earlier in the year. And as we've been paying attention in this moment, which is important to ground, we're on day 400 of genocide, but we're on day 36 of the siege of the north. And the siege of the north is a tightening of the siege that already existed, right? And it's a siege that even predates the beginning of this campaign, this genocidal campaign. It's a siege that's been in place since 2006 at the earliest, thinking about a land siege and a naval blockade. But 1993, if you go back to when Gaza is first circumscribed by barbed wire, as a way to prepare for peace. The irony is that the preparation for peace was a program to isolate and separate the Gaza Strip from the rest of the question of Palestine, and to call it the Palestinian state-led, and never to leave the West Bank to negotiation. But it was done in the language of peace, that this doublespeak continues. But now here we are, of this 36 days of this particular campaign, and we got the earliest indication of it on day 6 of this genocide, when there was an order to evacuate the north to below the Wadi Gaza line, right? The line which was the order, if you remember, when 1.1 million Palestinians, that's more than half the population besieged, was ordered to leave the north to below the Wadi Gaza line. But note that that removal was a death sentence. As the World Health Organization called it a death sentence, how do you remove the immobile? How do you force the sick to travel? And those that did take the risk and travel were targeted on the humanitarian lines that they were given, indicating to us on day 6 that there would be no safe quarter, that this was a campaign of genocide. And it's why Holocaust studies scholar Ross Segal, the very next day, published in Jewish Currents, this is a textbook case of genocide, right? And it's why 800 Twail scholars, Third World Approaches to International Law scholars, when people call me international law, you know, the constant question that I get is, how do you still believe in the law? And I'm like, I'm a TWAIL scholar. We never believed in it. We've been telling you it is a source and a site of oppression and colonial domination. My book tries to see that.
Yes.
And tries to demonstrate how, despite this colonial structure, we can use it for emancipatory purposes under which circumstances, right? Use it when it suits us. Abandon it when it doesn't. Create new law when we can. It is a tool. It is not the word of God. It is not holy. It is subject to change and to change by us. So those 812 scholars who know that said, raising the alarm, this is genocide. This was all within the first week. All within the first week. And now we're hearing something known as the General's Plan. The General's Plan, which is the formula for exterminating the North, that 400,000 people total Palestinians left in the North, 100,000 particularly in the area now marked for ethnic cleansing. The General's Plan is the brainchild of General Giora. What is his first name? Giora Eland, who proposes this plan. Giora Eland was also the architect of the Eland plan in the early 2000s, which competed with Ariel Sharon's plan for unilateral withdrawal and disengagement, which was the withdrawal of Israeli settlers and the withdrawal of military installations, but the maintenance of occupation of Gaza. That Elon plan in the early 2000s was to ethnically cleanse all of Gaza into the Sinai. Right? So what the idea that he's now, and by the way, Medha Masr, so thanks to, you know, our partners, Medha Masr, have wrote beautifully and thoroughly about the Elon plan. But you have the 1993 circumscription of Gaza in preparation for peace. You have the Elon plan in the year 2000. You have the evacuation order on October 12th, which was called a death sentence. You have the calls that this is genocide since day seven. You have now the General's plan. We have a year, over a year, of bearing witness to what, you know, my job and other people's job has been to illuminate what can't be seen, what's been obfuscated. They have illuminated it for us. At this point, it is not about us telling you what you have to read between the lines. It's literally about what they don't want to hear, not what is not being revealed. Because they are telling us, they have shown us, it is evident, they are defending it. They call it self-defense. And they call the completion of the Nakba as the right to complete. So it's less obfuscation, right? And now it becomes more about, it's a battle of narrative. Who do you want to listen to?
Noura Erekat, professor at Rutgers University, author of Justice for Some, Law and the Question of Palestine. Speaking Sunday here in New York at the historic Riverside Church, at an event moderated by author Ta-Nehisi Coates, his new book, The Message. The event was hosted by the Palestine Festival of Literature. Also in that discussion, Kianga Yamata Taylor, Princeton University professor. To see our interview with her, go to democracynow.org. The next PALFEST event, Palestine Festival of Literature, will be held in London November 20th to mark the republication of Edward Said's book, The Question of Palestine, followed by events in Detroit, Philadelphia, and Minneapolis. When we come back, we'll speak with Dutch-Palestinian Middle East analyst Muin Rabbani about Gaza, about Qatar suspending mediation talks between Israel and Hamas for a Gaza ceasefire, about Saudi Arabia hosting world leaders for an Arab Islamic summit, and about protests in Amsterdam, where he is. Stay with us. My name, Flock One, had his own son here to do. The move, the heart, sort out the light, low, the not decide to be fame. Daylight, no benign to know how. Don't come a lot of things for life, but keep your arms raised. Listen to this rap alone. Know Me by Mint Royale featuring De La Soul's Pastanus. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. We continue to look at Gaza, where Israeli forces launched a deadly attack early Sunday morning on a residential area in Jabalia, where displaced Palestinians were attempting to shelter, killing at least 36 people, including over a dozen children. Dozens of the victims were reportedly members of the same family asleep when Israeli forces attacked their home. An eyewitness who lost several relatives described the horrific scene.
We were just sitting peacefully. These are innocent citizens who don't belong to any military organization or faction. The eldest man is 70 years old. The house of Abu Sab Alush, Ali Alush, was bombed over the residents' heads without warning, which led to the martyrdom of everyone inside, more than 30 martyrs. Those who were lucky enough to survive were thrown onto the trees, onto the neighbors, and the remains are still scattered under the rubble.
Palestinian journalist Mohammed Khreis was killed along with his wife after an Israeli airstrike on their tent in the Nuseirat refugee camp. At least three more Gazan journalists were also killed in the Israeli strikes over the weekend. The attacks happened as the people of Gaza marked over 400 days since Israel launched its latest war, and as northern Gaza remains under a brutal siege, with hospitals surrounded by Israeli forces who have issued forced evacuation orders. But doctors and medical staff have refused to leave their patients behind. Amidst Israel's relentless attacks, the Palestine Red Crescent Society helped evacuate some 20 patients from Al-Auda Hospital in Jabalia and transferred them to Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City. BRCS reported at least one of the patients died as the ambulances were held up for hours at an Israeli checkpoint. Meanwhile, the UN-backed Famine Review Committee has joined other humanitarian groups in issuing a dire warning that there is a, quote, strong likelihood that famine is imminent in areas of northern Gaza. This all comes as Qatar suspended its efforts to mediate a Gaza ceasefire and hostage release deal until they say Israel and Hamas show, quote, willingness and seriousness to resume negotiations. Israel also carried out deadly strikes on Lebanon and Syria over the weekend, while the United States bombed Yemen over the past two nights. For more, we go to The Hague, where we're joined by Muin Rabbani, Dutch-Palestinian Middle East analyst, host of the Connections podcast. He's former senior analyst for the International Crisis Group and a contributor to the book Deluge, Gaza and Israel from Crisis to Catalysm. Muin, welcome back to Democracy Now! In a minute, we're going to ask you about the latest in Amsterdam, where police beat and arrested more than 100 pro-Palestinian protesters Sunday after they defied a ban on demonstrations following street clashes between visiting Israeli soccer fans and Dutch youth. But first, can you talk about the significance of Qatar temporarily withdrawing as a mediator between Israel and Hamas for the Gaza ceasefire talks, and about what's happening currently in Riyadh?
Yes, well, turning to Qatar first, several days ago, there were press reports that Qatar was going to, as you mentioned, suspend its mediation and also show the Hamas exile leadership that has been based in Qatar the door and ask them to leave the country in response to U.S. pressure. The expulsion of the Hamas leaders has been denied by Qatar, but it has indeed, as you mentioned, confirmed that it is suspending its mediation, saying basically that the parties aren't serious. And I think my own view is that this is something that Qatar and the other mediator, Egypt as well, should have done months ago when it became entirely apparent that there never were serious ceasefire negotiations and that this process was essentially serving as a fig leaf for Israel and for the United States to continue with their war of annihilation in the Gaza Strip and deflect criticism by claiming that they're involved in earnest initiatives to try to put an end to this war, as many of your listeners and viewers will know, every time there appears to be progress, the Israeli leader Benjamin Netanyahu shifts the goalposts and we're back to square one. And then Antony Blinken is trotted out to say that Hamas is the obstacle. So I think it's a good thing that these, at least that Qatar has suspended its efforts, and hopefully Egypt will do so soon as well, because this entire process has from the outset been a complete charade.
So talk about what's happening right now in Riyadh. Somewhat 60 world leaders, including the Syrian President Assad, including Erdogan and others, the Turkish president, are in Saudi Arabia right now. Talk about the significance of this, and then what this means in after the election of Donald Trump.
Well, this is the second such summit. The first was held, if I'm not mistaken, in late November or early December last year. It was supposed to be an emergency Arab League summit, but the Saudi de facto leader, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, then expanded it to also include the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. Many people felt that was an attempt to seek to dilute the decisions that would be reached by this enlarged conference. And indeed, the only relevant resolution that they adopted was that they would immediately begin providing humanitarian supplies to the Gaza Strip, irrespective of any Israeli restrictions. And in fact, they did absolutely nothing and delivered nothing unless they had Israeli approval to do so. This is now, if you will, a follow-up summit. It's possible that this one could be more serious because there is, as you know, a very significant risk now of an all-out war that would include Israel and Iran trading blows directly at each other. And I think Saudi Arabia and other Gulf Cooperation Council states are very much worried about being in the front line of any such conflict and being left with the consequences in terms of attacks on their own oil facilities and territory and so on. I mean, these are countries that had formerly looked to Israel as a reliable or potentially reliable security partner, but now see an Israeli government determined to set the entire region aflame, and they want to ensure that they're not consumed by those flames.
So where does Trump fit into this picture? Well known to be extremely close as his son, son-in-law is also extremely close to the Saudi Arabian Prince Salman.
Yes. Well, as you mentioned, the relationship between the Saudi Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, and the American Crown Prince, Prince Jared of Kushner, is known to be very close. It's less clear what a second Trump administration will mean for the region. Will it be a continuation of Biden's policies towards the region, which were very much a continuation of the first Trump's administration's policies towards the region? Will Trump intensify, hard as that may be to believe, U.S. support for Israel and sign off on open warfare against Iran? Or will he also respond to those isolationist and anti-war elements among his constituency and seek to ensure that the U.S. is not drawn directly into an armed conflict in the Middle East, which would also mean using some leverage on Israel not to escalate matters further? The problem with Trump is that he is so erratic, and we still don't know who he's going to surround himself with, that it's very difficult to speculate about what the first months of a second Trump administration are going to bring. He's already, for example, indicated that Mike Pompeo and Nikki Haley, two well-known Middle East hawks, will not be part of his administration. But against that, he's also been closely working with Brian Hook, a well-known Iran hawk, and has indicated that his new ambassador to the United Nations will be Congresswoman Stefanik, who is also well-known for her very, very radical positions with respect to the region.
I wanted to ask you about where you are right now. You're at The Hague, Muin Rabbani, but I want to ask you about the latest news nearby in Amsterdam, where police beat and arrested more than 100 pro-Palestinian protesters on Sunday after they defied a ban on demonstrations following street clashes between visiting Israeli soccer fans, many of them violent, and Dutch youth. Unrest in the city began on Wednesday when fans of the Maccabi Tel Aviv football team were seen chanting such slogans, and I want to get those slogans right, but I'll be careful in what I say. Let the IDF win and F the Arabs, but of course they say F, referring to the Israeli army's offensive in Gaza. Another video captured a fan screaming, F you terrorists, Sinwar die. Everybody die, in reference to the Hamas leader who was assassinated last month. Amsterdam's mayor blamed, quote, anti-Semitic hit and run squads. But many observers in Amsterdam said the Israeli fans were responsible for instigating the violence, the Israeli soccer fans known as hooligans. The violence grew into an international story as Israel sent planes to evacuate the Israeli fans. On Sunday, the Israeli journalist Gideon Levy wrote a piece for the newspaper Haaretz in Israel, headlined, "The Amsterdam attack shows Israelis' denial of the reality they created." In it, Gideon Levy writes, quote, "Why do they hate us so much? No, it's not because we're Jews. Not that there isn't anti-Semitism. Of course there is, and it must be fought. But the attempt to pin everything on it is ridiculous and mendacious. The North African immigrants, the Arabs and the Dutch people who rioted, saw the horrors in Gaza over the past year. They're not willing to remain silent about them. This is another cost of the war in Gaza that should have been considered. The world will hate us for it. Every Israeli abroad will be a target for hatred and violence from now on. That's what happens when you kill almost 20,000 children, carry out ethnic cleansing, and destroy the Gaza Strip. It's a little quirk of the world. It doesn't like those who commit these sorts of crimes." Again, those are the words of the Israeli journalist Gideon Levy in a piece for Haaretz. Muin Rabbani, can you talk about what happened?
Yes. Well, just to pick up where you left off, in fact, their favorite slogans were "Death to the Arabs, may your village burn, and there is no school in Gaza because all the children are dead." But it wasn't just about racist and genocidal slogans. These Israeli soccer hooligans, thugs, if you will, also engaged in property destruction, assaulting people of Arab appearance, assaulting taxis, and totaling one of them. And more importantly, they were allowed to do all this under police protection. If you compare it to British football, for example, when British teams play abroad, the British government sends police details with them, not to protect the hooligans, but to restrain them and ensure that they're unable to do any damage. And so what we're talking about here in Amsterdam is not a clash between the hooligans of two opposing sides, but rather these Israeli thugs attacking people who, in principle, had nothing to do with the game, and then afterwards being confronted by their victims with some violence included. And then you had kind of a power struggle within the Dutch elites. Geert Wilders, the far right, effectively the ruler of the Netherlands, seeking to undermine the government and prime minister he appointed in order to increase his power over them. That government seeking to retain its fiefdom, if you will, his coalition partners seeking to maintain their power. So they all began kind of outbidding each other and demonizing their own citizens and calling these clashes an anti-Semitic Jew hunt, which would only make sense if one could demonstrate that the victims of these clashes were not just supporters of the Israeli team or Israelis more generally, but also Dutch Jews and Dutch Jewish institutions and Dutch Jewish properties. And there's no evidence that such attacks took place, or even that the Dutch Jewish community, which of course would have been understandably fearful given all these reports they were receiving about Jew hunt and anti-Semitic pogrom and so on, there's no evidence that they even asked for police protection on the night in question. And so, you know, the government, Wilders, the mayor of Amsterdam, have all been going to increasing extremes of trying to compare what happened to the Nazi occupation, the German occupation of the Netherlands during the 1940s.
Let me play, Muin, for you what the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu said. He's spoken with U.S. President-elect Donald Trump three times in the past few days, also commenting on what happened in Amsterdam on Thursday night.
Yesterday we marked the Kristallnacht that happened 86 years ago on European soil. It was a brutal and violent attack against Jews, just because they were Jews. Unfortunately, in the last few days, we saw pictures that recall that night. In the streets of Amsterdam, anti-Semitic rioters attacked Jews, Israeli citizens, just because they were Jews. But there is one big difference between that night and our time. Today, we have a state.
Your response to the Israeli Prime Minister, Muin Rabbani.
Well, the key difference, of course, between Kristallnacht in November 1938 and what we saw in Amsterdam on the 7th of November is that the properties that were marked for assault and attack were targeted because they were, for example, displaying Palestinian flags, not menorahs. So that's kind of a key difference. And, you know, all this talk about that these people were singled out because they were Jews rather than because they were football supporters or presumed to be supporters of this racist, genocidal gang of soccer hooligans is really just, you know, trying once again to make the point that the real victims here are not the children who are being slaughtered in the Gaza Strip. The real victims are those who are engaging in the slaughter and those who are perpetrating the genocide. And what has happened now is that the Dutch government, municipality of Amsterdam, the Amsterdam police have put in emergency measures banning all demonstrations in opposition to the genocide. And as you mentioned, have now started arresting dozens of people who have violated that ban to assemble peacefully to protest what is happening in Gaza. There's a larger background here, of course, which is the failure, the refusal of the international soccer authorities known as FIFA and UEFA to take any measures against Israel, the Israeli Football Association, Israeli football clubs, in sharp contrast to their immediate imposition of comprehensive measures against the Russian Federation and Russian teams literally within days of the Russian invasion of Ukraine.
We only have 30 seconds, but can you finally comment on what's happening in Lebanon, the thousands of people killed, the attacks continuing, particularly in southern Lebanon, despite Israel claiming ceasefire talks are progressing?
Yes, well, Israel is failing militarily. It's still stuck on the border zone and is therefore taking out its anger, its aggression on the Lebanese civilian population and hoping to use that as a form of pressure on the government and on Hezbollah to achieve something.
I want to thank you so much, Muin, for joining us. Muin Rabbani, Dutch-Palestinian Middle East analyst, host of the Connections podcast, former senior analyst for the International Crisis Group, contributor to the book Deluge, Gaza and Israel from Crisis to Cataclysm. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for our video news production and digital fellowships. Go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us for another edition of Democracy Now!
Hi, this is Jesse Brown, the host of Canada Land, Canada's only media criticism program. Every week I talk to some of the most interesting people in the country about some of the things that matter most. We talk about the news media, about comedy, film, music, and politics. And you can now listen on CJSF 90.1 FM every Monday at 5 p.m. Wait for it.
The screen therapy